2010 is seeing several books come out that have a nostalgic theme. There are biographies about Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris and Hank Aaron. There are also a fair number of books about baseball cards, which is people, mostly men of a certain age, know. We grew up with back in the 70s, 80s, and even before. At the time, kids don't think about the monetary aspects of it, but it has become a big business. And one of the books out this year is Mint Condition, How Baseball Cards Became an American Obsession by Dave Jamieson. And we're very happy that he has a few minutes to spend with us. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning, Ron. Thanks for having me.
So I do not, you'll forgive me, I do not know your age offhand, but I'm kind of thinking that you came to this not as early as some of us did.
I'm 31 years old. I collected, you know, rabidly as a kid. You know, I'd say probably between ages 7 and 13, I would guess. And so I kind of got into it really when this was, you know, kind of a booming industry in the late 80s and early 90s. And like a lot of kids, I you know, once I hit around high school, I drifted away from it and got interested in other things, high school stuff, girls. And so I got away from it, it was years and years before I came back to it. And it was really just, you know, a couple years ago, you know, when I rediscovered my cards at my childhood house when it was being sold, and that's really what started this whole kind of look back into the world of baseball cards for me.
Well, as you say in the book, you're luckier than a lot of us who've gone back home only to find out that our parents have thrown out those cards.
That's right. Yeah, I mean that you know that's kind of an old line. You hear that all the time. My mom threw out my cards, and you know that really is. A lot of moms did throw them out. Of course, that doesn't happen so much these days, and it didn't happen so much in my day even, you know, because, you know, and that kind of explains a lot of the market for baseball cards is the really old ones are worth money because mom threw them out in the 50s and 60s and earlier than that. But the more modern cards from the 80s and 90s, you know, they're not valuable because mom never threw them out because everybody was collecting them with the idea that they were, you know, worth some kind of money. And so that kind of, you know, when mom stopped throwing them out, that really, that plays into why a lot of these are really not worth so much anymore these days.
So you mean as a 7, 8, 9-year-old, you were buying cards with the idea of putting them in the safety deposit box for future considerations?
Yeah, it sounds insane. I don't know how old, you know, you are, Ron, but, you know, in earlier generations, you know, you didn't equate cards with money. But, you know, when I came of age in the 80s, there were already adult collectors who had created a market for this stuff. You know, there were card shops in basically every major town out there. You know, at one point, I think it was around 1990, there were more than 10,000 card shops in the country, and they weren't just, you know, selling, you know, 45-cent wax packs. They were, you know, selling these pristine cards that were, you know, encased in plastic beneath glass cases with very high stickers on them. And so, you know, kids in my era, you know, were brought up to believe that these cards were not something that you know you were supposed to throw against the wall. You know these things were worth money, and that created really a lot of problems in the industry, I think.
Well, one thing I vividly recall is a project in middle school where I took it was a card set from the late 60s. And I took all the stars, the Willie Mays, the Carl Yastrzemskis, I made an all-star team out of them, and I glued them onto a piece of oak tag, rendering
right.
them totally worthless at this point, even if I could find them. But your book goes in great depth as far as the industry goes. When did you become interested in that aspect of it?
Well, that kind of bubbled up pretty quickly for me. I mean, it's probably not unfair to call the book a business story or business history, though I hope it's not as dry as that sounds. You know, I really, when I first started researching, I mean, you know, it was a logical move, you know, when I first started to look at the first baseball cards. And the first ones were, you know, created more or less by the tobacco industry in the 1800s, and the idea was to use them, flip them into packs of cigarettes to for marketing purposes and to create, you know, brand loyalty with people. And, you know, these were insanely popular with kids. They would beg their fathers to buy one brand rather than another. And the kids themselves would buy packs of cigarettes to actually help expose a lot of kids to smoking, you know, in the 1880s. And so just seeing this kind of, I was pretty fascinated by that, you know, the role that these baseball cards had played in really getting the cigarette industry off the ground, because they were still relatively new at that stage. And so really over time, I mean, cards have been around for 120, 130 years now, and it's been fascinating the way they've, you know, evolved in the way that the role they've played in different industries. I mean, they really helped give rise not just to cigarettes, but also to the candy industry and to the gum industry. We all know, you know, the name Tops. And so, you know, that's how I became really interested in the baseball card industry. And, of course, it was many years before the cards became kind of the main feature. You know, for a lot of years it was supposed to be, this card was thrown in there to kind of sweeten the pot, to get you to buy, you know, a plug of tobacco or a piece of gum or a thing of candy. But eventually, you know, by the 50s, with the you know, it was such a golden age of baseball with these great Yankees-Dodgers rivalries, you know, that you know, baseball cards really became the main feature. And ever since then, you know, they've been their own industry, and at certain points quite a strong, robust industry, and at others, like now, kind of a rather weak one.
What happened, what was the turning point in 1951, when Topps really exploded the scene? What happened at that point to do this?
Well, there was a lot of things going on. I mean, I think the main thing was Topps, you know, more than anybody else, had this great foresight that baseball was, of course, it was already a huge part of kids' lives, but they really invested into this idea of baseball cards right as baby boomers were starting to fill little league fields all over the place, and right when baseball was on the verge of, you know, arguably its greatest era ever. And so Topps really, you know, amazingly, they did so much to, and, you know, again, this being, like I said, Laura, very much a business story, you know, I was fascinated by how cutthroat a lot of their tactics were in really cornering the card market. And a lot of this overlaps with professional baseball in fascinating ways. I mean, Topps, you know, for one thing, developed their own scouting system so that, you know, they could sign prospects at rock-bottom prices to get, you know, the rights to their images. So if you were, you know, some rising star, you know, 19-year-old kid in 1954, you know, eventually a Topps contract was going to be put under your nose and you get $5 for signing. It was called stake money. And that's really how Topps managed to run away with the market and really, you know, demolish companies like Bowman, who they eventually bought out. It was a company that, you know, made a lot of really beautiful cards in the early 50s. Topps bought them out, and they also managed to freeze out Fleer, which was eventually became a major manufacturer, but it wasn't for many years, you know, until the Topps monopoly was broken by a federal ruling. So, you know, Topps basically enjoyed a monopoly for you know, 25-odd years, you know, thanks to these very aggressive tactics they carried out.
Now, in the, I guess it was the middle 80s, when that monopoly was busted, you had new sets coming out. You had Fleer, you had Upper Deck, you had Score. Some were better than others. What happened artistically to the cards at that point?
Well, just to give a little background, and I think your listeners and readers would appreciate this because of the role it played in baseball. The leading up to the monopoly being broken, when Marvin Miller came to the head the players union in the mid '60s, well, you know, one of the very first thing, his first order of business was to go after Topps, because, you know, he believed that Topps had this outrageously lopsided arrangement with the players, which in a lot of ways they probably did. And back, you know, in those days, a lot of players had more kind of, you know, working man salaries, of course, than they do today. So, you know, Miller started these marathon negotiations with Topps and really, in the end, got the upper hand and was able to establish a royalty structure. And this became a huge deal for the players' union over the years. They got they really were able to fill their coffers off of baseball cards, because the industry just really took off in the 80s. Like I said, when you know, Fleer and Donruss came in, you know, Topps was always worried that if they had any competitors that they wouldn't be able to sell any cards. But in the end, it was the exact opposite. Everybody, you know, made out like bandits, because kids just couldn't get enough of these, it seemed. So in the 80s, you had Topps, Fleer, Donruss, and some other smaller ones coming into play. And you know, you asked artistically what happened. Well, it was probably a little better than when Topps had its monopoly, because, you know, Topps, every year they didn't have to worry about any competitors, and their offerings got pretty sloppy in the 70s. You know, if you look at cards from the 50s, they're so beautiful, and I think that's because this was this very, you know, artistically creative period at these places like Topps and Bowman when they were competing with one another. In the 70s, you know, they start to get a little sort of indistinguishable during periods. But at least in the 80s, you know, kids had different sets to choose from. And like I said, it seemed like rather than have just one, they were really happy to have all three of them.
Last year, I believe, Major League Baseball designated Topps as the official baseball card. What exactly does that mean?
Well, that what it means is leading up to last year, the main two companies making cards were Topps and Upper Deck, which is a company out of California, which really kind of revolutionized baseball card industry around 1989. That was the company that created these really slick, you know, expensive cards that were, you know, overtly, you know, for investment-minded people. So it got to the point where really the only two, you know, because the industry had been struggling so badly for years since 94, really since the baseball strike, it really just came down to Topps and Upper Deck. The others kind of fell by the wayside. And eventually last year, you know, Major League Baseball said, okay, now we're strictly going to give a license to Topps, which means Upper Deck can't put logos on their cards, which obviously creates a large problem for you. And I think the reason Major League Baseball did that is they're really trying to simplify the hobby. You know, baseball and baseball cards have always been cross-promotional, and they've always been great publicity for baseball itself. There's no doubt about that. You know, having kids trading baseball cards is very good for Major League Baseball. So I think Topps is hoping that with just one player out there, the industry will get simplified the way it needs to be attractive to kids. You know, Michael Eisner, of Disney fame, heads up. He headed up a private equity group that bought Topps, and Major League Baseball is basically making a bet here that Eisner can get things together and bring kids back into the hobby, and that it's better if he and Topps try to do that alone.
Now, first there were, well, mainly speaking, first there was Topps, then there were in the 80s these others. They used to include subsets within the general card population. Now, there are, do you have a sense of how many different sets are available in an average year now?
It's probably still too many. I don't know exactly how many there are this year. I don't know how many Topps is rolling out. The problem was for a lot of years in the 90s and early 2000s, there were so many, not just companies, but sets. It was not even just dozens. It could be over 100. And it became this really overwhelming thing for kids. You know, kids obviously, if there's 100 different sets, you know, they're not even going to be trading the same cards. It's just very confusing. So they're trying to streamline it now and you know, get it down to a more manageable number. Exactly how many that is, I don't know, but I'm sure it's a lot better than it was a few years ago, considering it's just going to be one card maker right now.
So then never mind the difference in card sets, but the prices of some of these things are out of the reach of kids.
Yeah, and a lot of them still are, and it's, you know, for anybody who's a casual, or who was a casual collector, I should say, because most guys were at some point or another. I mean, even kids who weren't into baseball, at least in my generation, traded baseball cards at some point or another. Anybody who didn't, you know, collect all their lives into adulthood, and neither did I, if you went and look back, if you take a look at what's out there right now, a lot of it's just kind of weird. You know, there's, for one thing, you know, the flashiest cards these days have pieces of game-used uniforms on them, pieces of bats. And beyond that, there's, you know, really strange stuff. You know, some of the cards that have gotten some odd publicity in the last couple of years include cards with strands of hair from George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. You know, they call them DNA cards. Very odd stuff that's out there. And these are kind of put in the packs. It's kind of like winning a lotto ticket. You know, you buy this really expensive pack, maybe for $50 or more, and hoping to find some kind of odd, you know, little treasure in there. And obviously, you know, what kid is not only is that, you know, just kind of odd, but the price structure pushes children completely out of it. So, you know, I think they're Major League Baseball is certainly trying to go in a different direction than that. It doesn't help them at all. And Topps, you know, to their credit, has introduced, you know, dollar packs recently, which is a little more along the lines of what you could expect from a child.
Sure, sure. So do you have a favorite card?
I do. You know, my favorite's my 84 Don Mattingly rookie. You know, I grew up in North Jersey, Yankees fan, and you know that card was it was a really big deal to me as a kid. And like I was saying earlier, you know, even in the 80s, you know, we were, you know, there was, these cards were getting valuable, and we were considering them money. I think I bought that card, if I recall, for either $28 or $32. I should say I had it bought for me. It was a Christmas present. So that was, you know, he was, you know, Donnie Baseball was my hero as a kid. And, you know, that card was, once I got it, you know, it went into a case and I pulled it out and looked at it every once in a while. I never traded it, never wanted to trade it. And I still have it today. And, you know, I can see, you know, in my mind what that card looks like with, you know, Mattingly, you know, in a bit of a crouch over near first base. And you know, I think that's kind of the nice thing about cards is they, you know, if you hang on to them, and a lot of them aren't worth selling, I wouldn't even recommend you sell yours if you're like me from the 80s. You just hang on to them, and you pull them out every few years, and kind of reminds you of wherever you were when you were 8 or 9 years old and the kid you were growing up with.
Very good. Well said. Again, we've been talking with Dave Jamieson, author of Mint Condition, How Baseball Cards Became an American Obsession. Thank you very much for your time, Dave.
Appreciate it, Ron.